after they were offered a settlement.
Raj is looking at me expectantly. So
yes, he's got to go early, so go ahead.
Okay. Well, it's hard to know where to begin to introduce Professor Ed Fredkin. I guess I'll start at the end and work backwards. You might know the name because we have a conference room called the Fredkin Conference Room. You might know him because we have a Fredkin Research Professor, which is Red Whitaker, and we also have a Fredkin Professor, which is Tom Mitchell. So there's a lot of Fredkins going on around here, but Ed Fredkin is the original. And now, jumping back to the start, when I was a freshman at MIT, I was in this crazy thing called the Experimental Study Group. The idea was you didn't need grades or courses or anything like that. I don't think it's a good idea after all, but at the time I liked it. The best thing about it was the first research talk I ever saw in my life was Ed Fredkin came in and talked to us about digital physics, about using cellular automata and how the little patterns that evolve in cellular automata could be a model for fundamental physics. A wildly crazy idea, one that became very popular, much ballyhooed many years later. And this kind of set the pattern for me, because I thought, wow, what a wild and crazy idea. It looks interesting. Not for me. And then, not long after that, I was working in an AI lab in robotics. Ed was working on an idea that was a single actuator locomotion device. It was the simplest locomotion device that I think anybody had proposed. I don't know if it had a name then.
The hinge robot.
The hinge robot. Another idea, I thought, this is a wild and crazy idea, not for me. Okay, I'm working on it now. So it's been more than 10 years. I think that's how long it takes for me to realize that one of those ideas.
That was 1978, I think, when that happened.
So it has another name now. There are lots of people that have worked on that idea, and they call it the Acrobot sometimes. So it is something that's actually had a substantial impact in robotics. There's much, much more. Ed was involved in the very earliest systems to do desktop publishing. He was a founder of III. Wikipedia article says you wrote the PDP-1 assembler, is that right?
That's right.
On which I played spent many hours playing Space War. So never heard that, but I owe Ed. So I think I'll stop there. There's much more, but it'd be more fun to listen to Ed's newest idea. So
okay.
Thanks for coming, Ed.
Thank you. Okay, first, this talk isn't really so much about transportation as it's about energy. And of course, energy is connected very closely with transportation. So the idea is there's a kind of energy problem brewing, and there's global warming and issues like that. And this is sort of my thoughts in response to all of that. A lot of my thinking has to do with things I learned from John McCarthy, who was Raj Reddy's thesis supervisor at Stanford. And I try to apply this particular rule at the top there, John McCarthyism. The idea is that there's a whole series of problems that face us, and people are thinking of solutions and what to do, or they're thinking of ways to avoid things to do, and so on. And so I just want to try to apply a logical way of thinking about these things to the problems associated with global warming, energy, carbon in the atmosphere, and so on. And what happens is you come up with a bunch of possibilities, and that's what I'm going to describe, some of them. Okay. There's a funny thing. Richard Branson has offered a prize of $25 million to anyone who can figure out a way to remove 10 to the 9th tons of carbon per year from the atmosphere. About 35 years ago, John McCarthy said that he'd come up with a new idea. Don't worry about carbon in the atmosphere. We'll leave it to future generations who are smarter than us. So he asked me if I could sort of calculate what it might cost to remove carbon from the atmosphere. So I tried, and my conclusion was that if you had to process the air to get the carbon out, you'd already lost, because there's so much air, and just the mechanical handling of moving that much air was going to cost too much. And also, just a simple physics look, the entropy of all the carbon in one place where you want to put it as opposed to spread out in the atmosphere is quite different, and it costs a lot to deal with it. So what I came up with back then, and I don't remember exactly how I calculated it, was that it was grossly impractical to try by some artificial means. I mean, when planting trees probably does some good, but to remove carbon from the atmosphere. So Branson's money might be safe, I don't know. Okay, of course, I might be wrong too. Okay, now, there's an interesting thing. Years and years ago, I think on my first trip to Moscow, I saw a gigantic neon sign on top of a big, obviously a power plant, an electrical power plant. And so I had someone translate it for me, and what it said was this. It said, "Communism is socialist power plus the electrification of the whole country." This was a famous Lenin statement. Communism was some ideal they never got to, but the way to get there, they thought, was you have socialism, which was pretty bad as implemented there. You can abbreviate this with a little equation: communism is socialist power plus electrification of the country, and all the wise guys over in Russia like to do a little bit of algebra with that and come up with, well, that means electrification of the country equals communism but without socialist power. Okay, so that was a kind of Russian joke for a long time. It was funny back in those days. Okay, so I have a new slogan, which is reduced atmospheric carbon is conversion to nuclear power plus the electrification of transportation. Okay, in other words, transportation seems to need putting carbon in the atmosphere for the most part. Now, you might have a hydrogen-powered airplane or who knows what in the future, but basically cars, you know, trucks, things like that all burn petroleum or such products and so on. Now, you know, you're not going to put, there's a funny thing, in the late, after the first atomic bomb went off, all the popular magazines wrote articles about nuclear power. None of them knew much about what they were talking about. And they were predicting that soon buses and even cars would all have little nuclear power plants and so on. Didn't work out that way. Okay, here's the sort of picture. I like this. The U.S. Energy Department produced a kind of interesting graph. I don't have a pointer, but I can point, I guess, this way. Great, thank you. Okay. These are, as labeled, sources of energy, if you like, and here's where it goes. And so you see 68%, all these numbers are percentages, 68% of petroleum goes to transportation. Hardly any natural gas goes that way, but if you look at making electricity, you know, there's 26% of natural gas goes that way, and so on and so forth. So nuclear power sits down here, basically it just makes electricity. So we see this flow, and the question is, can you do anything about this? 98% of transportation comes from petroleum. The other thing that it would be nice to do something about is electricity. 52% comes from coal, 15% from natural gas, and 3% from petroleum, and all of those are adding carbon to the atmosphere. So there's something we'd like to do something about. Okay, so little facts, you know. There's an interesting thing. You know, so far prices are going up, but a lot of bad things could happen too. You know, the right kind of problems in the Middle East could cause a lot of mischief. A lot of our fuel is imported, of course. Okay, and my guess is that if we run into some severe problem, a reaction to it isn't going to be able to solve it quickly. The ideal thing would be to come up with some ways to get ourselves out of the box that we've sort of been building for ourselves by using petroleum products like mad while having to import them. Okay. So we need new sources of energy, okay, and maybe new means of delivering energy, okay. So, and we want to decrease fossil fuels. These are all kind of obvious things, just a list of obvious things, okay? Now, I believe robotics can help. It's not that we're going to run the robots more efficiently or something, but we'll see. I'll show you or tell you about what I think there. It's not so much that we have to invent some new kind of robotics or solve some new problem, but basically technologies that have already been done and demonstrated can help, and I'll discuss that. That has to do with transportation. There's an interesting thing about transportation, which is, you know, we think of it as moving a person from someplace A to someplace B, where A is, say, the Pittsburgh airport, and B is, say, the Boston airport, okay? Of course, the person has to get to the Pittsburgh airport, and he has to get through security and all those things. And what I want to do is to think of transportation where A is, say, Carnegie Mellon University, and B is, you know, some office at MIT where someone's going. Okay, and the question is, can autonomous vehicles help? Well, I think so in some ways, and we'll get to that. Okay, we don't need the highest technology of autonomous vehicles. Okay, now, there's this is a fact here, that nuclear plants, you know, making electricity is less polluting than probably any other way of getting electricity. Now, of course, nuclear power plants, a lot of people have a lot of complaints about them, but there may be ways to address that. As far as vehicles are concerned, when it comes to electricity, the main thing we're lacking is a magic battery. You know, if we just said, hey, I've got, you know, lithium poly, that's a great way to have a battery, about the best thing around, especially if you're making model airplanes or helicopters. You might as well have them be electrically powered these days with one of those batteries. But you need, you know, you'd really like 100 times the energy density there or something, maybe 10 times at least. But so there isn't a good, we don't have that magic battery that would just allow for efficient electric cars or something. Okay, so another thought is, can you get electricity to the vehicle? That's I'll never forget, my wife and I went on a tour in Australia of a mine. We were about 2 miles underground, and they had the most amazing vehicle. It was a truck, a front loader, and it moved very fast, like, you know, 30 miles an hour in a narrow, pitch black environment. The only light was its headlights as it went by. But what was interesting is on the back of it was a reel. It looked just like a fishing reel, except that its diameter was about close to 6 feet. And what was wound up in it wasn't fishing line, it was an extension cord. And this thing ran down at 35 miles an hour, peeling with a load of this was a lead zinc mine, a load of ore for a long ways, just reeling out this gigantic extension cord. And then when it dumped it, it ran backwards, reeling it up as it went. So that's one way. If you had a very long extension cord, you could drive to work that way, I suppose. But there has to be a better way. Okay. So, you know, there's hydro, which is not bad. China's got a very big hydro dam that is pretty spectacular. There's a great one in Brazil. The U.S., you know, generates some power that way. Wind and solar, you know, if you have enough wind power, probably you don't get a breeze anymore. There must be some law like that. Okay, and then you can burn coal and capture the CO2. That's fairly difficult. But nuclear power looks very, very nice. Okay. And then there's fusion power. That's way off in the future. There's a funny joke from the old Soviet Union, which I like, which is, the question was, what are the three uses for fusion power? And the answer is, well, there's the military use, you know, hydrogen bombs, okay? Then there's the peaceful use, you know, making electricity someday. And then there's personal. Okay, and the question is, what do you mean personal? And the answer is, oh, that's Velikov. Okay, the point is, he built his career by being a great expert in fusion and plasma physics and so on, and became a very senior guy scientifically, like the most important, and basically did it on the basis of fusion energy and so on. I saw him recently, and he had an interesting new idea, just as an aside here. But he told me something that intrigued me, that in Soviet days, they had a nuclear power reactor factory. Just one. And it built one reactor every 4 days. That's 90 a year. And he has a new idea, which is to build barges, to build another factory, to build barges that have nuclear power plants on them. You know, this is a barge, and it takes in cold seawater and lets out warm seawater and has a cable that delivers electricity. And they would tow these barges to any part of the world near the sea that needs power. And then when it needed to be processed or refueled, they tow it back to Russia, and avoid all the worries about people getting plutonium or, you know, that kind of thing and so on. So that's an idea he had recently. Well, thinking about that, I had an idea, which is, if you picked an area like Yucca Mountain, and maybe you could find, this is where there's a proposed facility for storing radioactive waste, and in Nevada. You could create an underground complex. Imagine underground, you put nuclear power plants, except for the cooling towers. You put the fuel reprocessing and the storage of radioactive waste in a transportation system. And basically, nothing radioactive would ever see the surface of the Earth. And you could. And it turns out that you could easily put hundreds or even 1,000 well-spread out nuclear power plants in one such geographic area, and you could pick a few others, and sort of eliminate many of the issues that bother people about nuclear power.
How are you going to cool them?
The cooling towers have to be on the surface.
How tall are those towers?
How tall are they?
Yeah.
Well, I don't. A typical cooling tower. There's two kinds. First of all, there's two kinds of cooling towers. There's what are called air-cooled, and the others use evaporating water to help cool. And the air-cooled have a higher capital cost and a lower operating cost, basically. And you know, you could use either kind of cooling tower. But every nuclear power plant or every power plant has cooling towers, whether it's coal. That's right. You can put a nuclear power plant essentially anywheres, okay, and use air to cool, okay? That's the way almost all nuclear power plants in the United States operate. By the way, while you may think it's nice to heat all that water, the fish might not like it, you know? Okay, so now one thing that ought to happen, a poor state like Nevada, ought to, you know, get the kind of money that Alaska got when they developed Prudhoe Bay in exchange. In other words, there's this NIMBY thing, not in my backyard, that no one wants this around them, but if it, it creates such a valuable facility for the whole United States that we ought to be able to pay, you know, that state something to make it happier. Now I'm getting on to, there's some magic slide here that won't stay. Okay. So I have the idea of a new way to deliver power to moving vehicles. And, you know, right now there are trains and subways and trolleys and electric powered buses that all pick up power from either wires or third rails or odds and ends of other ways. At San Francisco International, they have a little people mover thing that's on rubber tires and a concrete. It operates by itself, not too dissimilar from the what's at Pittsburgh Airport, except this one's going around corners and so on. And it picks up its power from a little set of copper strips that are enclosed in a plastic thing between the rails. And that works all weather and so on and so forth. So what I did was I came up with a new system for doing this, and I call it the power strip. And the idea of the power strip is this is something you could put in a regular road. Take a highway, an ordinary street, you could take one lane and equip it with a power strip. Then the power strip could deliver electrical power to vehicles, but it can't do it reliably, and I claim that is not a problem, and I'll explain why in a minute. Okay. Okay, the idea of the power strip is that it's flush with the surface of the road. A car can drive over it, or it doesn't matter, because it only has power while a vehicle receiving that power is over it, and nowhere else is there any voltage on it. Okay, so that's its little trick for safety, okay? Nowadays, the idea that the vehicle and the system that delivers the power can talk to each other, well, they can be on a wireless, you know, network and talk to each other. That's easy. Turning power on and off is now much easier because of insulated gate, bipolar transistors and things like that. That technology is pretty fantastic. We can meter the power. And here's the big thing. There are economical hybrid vehicles. If I talked to you and said, okay, and this was, say this was 10 or 15 years ago, and I said, we could build a car that has, you know, a little battery, but it has a motor, and the motor runs a generator, and the generator can, the internal combustion engine runs the generator, and it can act like a motor, and it can switch back and forth and do all those things, you would say, yeah. That would be too complicated to work and too expensive to make and so on and so forth. However, Toyota seems to be able to do it. They build the Prius and they now have a whole fleet of hybrids, hybrid Lexuses, hybrid SUVs, et cetera, and they all work. So I'm saying, fine, there's a wonderful thing about hybrids. Say they can pick up electricity from the roadway, but it can't be done reliably. By that I mean, if it suddenly starts raining, the system might shut off. Okay, or it might mean that, if it's up here and they just put salt on the road and the snow's melting, it might not work. Okay, so it would shut itself off. Okay, but hybrids don't need electricity, they just can benefit from it. So the fact is, if you can deliver electricity, 90% of the time a hybrid is driving in that lane, statistically, you've done a great thing because you've eliminated 90% of its fuel consumption. So I have this simple system. There's one strip, and whoops, I didn't even think I did anything there. Okay, stay there. Okay, there's one. I don't know what's going on with this, but we'll come back. Okay, memorize this quickly. Okay, if it tries to do something, I'll jump back. Okay, red means power, green is ground, okay? And the point is, right here, there's a pickup with three brushes, if you like, spaced out. And from here to here might be, say that's something like 18 inches from here to here. So you have this, these three pickups under the vehicle that are just connected physically together. And when it's over one of these strips, you put the thing down and it's going along. So what happens right now is it's getting power from here and ground to there. As it's moving along, that's what it's still doing. This one has now gotten to this strip and it gets turned on at this point. Okay, so now it's switch, while it has power both here and here, it switches from using this one to using that one. Okay, then it, the vehicle turns this one off. All this is happening in, you know, milliseconds or even, you know, hundreds of microseconds or something. Then it's drawing power from these. So the point is, this system lets it, lets you put down one strip. Okay, and the advantage of having one strip is I can get more insulation with a narrow strip than, you know, you can come up with other schemes with two strips, or I don't care about what the scheme is, but the point is this would work, and so might even better ideas and so on, so that the vehicle can put this down on this surface here, which is flush with the road, and pick up power. I've imagined a big vehicle, a great big machine, that drives down a highway at 2 miles an hour and leaves this thing behind it. Okay? Of course, you have to have other work done on the side of the road where the power has to be brought over to the strips and so on. Now, included in this thing is the fact that the vehicle talks to the strip system, you know, and the strip system talks to the vehicle, and, you know, it's going to bill the guy for the electricity he used and so on and so forth, and that's how you pay for putting this in and so on. So what this is an existence proof that some such system is possible, and the great win is there's no requirement that it work all the time. You see, with a train or an electric bus, it has to work all the time. Okay, this one doesn't. It might work in the rain, and if it doesn't, that's okay too. Okay, now, when I first came up with the idea, I had in mind that underneath the car was a servo that moved it from left to right. So that if you drove the car and you happened to get over this lane, it would position it, but you didn't have to drive very accurately. Then it occurred to me, well, you know, you wonder about how hard would it be to have computer-operated steering in a car, you know, as an addition to the ordinary car. Well, that's answered by Toyota again. Namely, there is a model of Lexus that has computer-operated steering that works along with human-operated steering, in the sense, but they've only using it to park the car automatically. But a modern Lexus, which you can go to the store and buy today, you know, can park itself, parallel park, which is a bit of robotic driving. It's a cute introductory thing because the speed is fairly low. Could still run someone over, I suppose, anyway. So these are just some of the facts I've mentioned, that here you can complain that sometimes it won't work, but we don't care that much. Now I want to get to sort of the meat of this talk, which is a new kind of train-like thing. Okay. What I imagine is that, and I started out thinking about this in one way, and this may not be the right way, but it's fun, and that is to reduce the cost the way computers reduce costs. There's Moore's law. How does it work? The way Moore thought of his law was that the component, the number of components you can put on a chip goes up by a factor of two every couple of years, something like that. That's not exactly what he said, but the main point is the cost goes down, and what the driving force of the cost going down is miniaturization. We can miniaturize a transistor, and we can miniaturize the gates and flip-flops that go into, and memories and processors that go into computers. Okay. So I thought, well, can you miniaturize a train? Of course, There's the little model trains, but, you know, we want to miniaturize a train that people go into. Well, the question is, railroad cars are very big and very heavy, and there's some, you might say, why? And there are good reasons why, but those reasons can be changed, and you can do certain miniaturization. So I thought to myself, well, like a car is much miniaturized instead of a railroad car. Okay. Does anyone know, if you had to go from here to Los Angeles, what's the most expensive way you could choose to do that?
Walk.
No? Walk? That's, no, I meant out-of-pocket money.
But you've got to pay for food.
No, but you can go much more expensively than that.
Ship.
No, can't compare.
Private jet,
yes, a corporate jet or something. Boy, are they expensive. You can call up and say, hey, I want to get to L.A. the fastest way. If you really mean the fastest, that's not, you see, you can do the following thing. You want to go nonstop to Singapore? You can leave from Allegheny County Airport nonstop to Singapore, okay? Or any other point in the world on a Gulfstream 5, okay? Such a trip would cost you, you know, you just say you want to go one way. It actually costs the same as round trip as long as you come back soon, okay? If you went one way, it's about, you know, $250,000 to $300,000. Just one trip, all by yourself, okay? Now, there are the fastest jet for corporate travel is the Citation 10, okay? Now, is an interesting thing about the Citation 10. Its cabin is much smaller. You can't quite stand up straight in it. Okay, so now you can get in a regular bus where you stand up straight, or a train where you stand up straight, but if you want to spend 1,000 times as much money, you might not be able to stand up straight. So it must be okay to travel without being in a great big vehicle. And in fact, there are corporate jets that would cost you, you know, only $20,000 for a trip like that, where you basically, you know, the cabin's about this high, and you go like this to get to your seat, and then you sit down, and you're very comfortable. Okay. But there's some nice things about corporate travel, because what happens is your limo, of course you would have to have a limo if you're going to pay for all the rest, drives you to the airplane. Even in today's world, and you take your bags out, they're put in the plane with you, which means no lost baggage, and then you get in the plane, and when at the other end, your limo drives out to the plane to pick you up. It's very civilized, okay? Very, okay. So, I'm interested in making something even more civilized, but not so expensive. My idea is, can we make a cabin? Maybe it's something like the interior of a corporate jet, so that four guys from here could get in, and a corporate jet, you know, you can have high-speed internet, telephones, whatever, television, you know, what stuff like that, and cabin attendant, if you want one, who serves you food and all kinds of things like that. Could something pick you up at CMU, and deliver you, say, to Chicago fast without you, and deliver you to the other door without you having to get out? Okay. Carry you continuously from one end of the journey to another. And of course, freight can be treated similarly. Okay. So I wanted to try and do all of these things, and so I came up with an idea. This would be an electrically powered vehicle, basically. It would have a battery that's good for, could maybe drive it a kilometer or two at low speed or a little ways at high speed. It has a lot of robotics. Now, it might have rubber tires. Oh, it would have rubber tires, but it might also be able to go on railroad tracks. These are all variables that you can crank. But one of the interesting things is one of these vehicles can automatically couple or decouple from another, so they could organize themselves in trains. And, there'd be a variety of different styles, some sort of high-density seating for coach-like, and some, like a private small or medium-sized cabin in a jet. Okay. There's safety issues and such. Now, I couldn't think of an easy way to do animation in PowerPoint, so I just drew a time series. If you imagine these, this is a train of some such vehicles, and as it's going along, it's slowed down to say 60 miles an hour. It opens up here, and then opens up here automatically. Then this thing starts moving off to the side, and it moves off to about this position. Then the train can close up, keep going, and this thing goes somewhere else. This one, this is actually the same slide turned upside down and rotated. So you see it. So here we have something traveling along the same speed as the train, and it wants to join up as you come down here, and you get to here, and it's joined up with the train. I'll explain what that's all about in a minute. I posed this problem to a 14-year-old who knew how to use Flash, and he struggled for a long time and came up with, I'm going the wrong way, with this thing. Okay, so here's the train going along as he imagines it, and this part comes over, slides in, and then the train closes up. Okay. I'll show you this one in a little while. Yeah. Okay, so the idea of this vehicle is that it's capable of some autonomous driving under controlled conditions, and I'll explain when it does that. One example is you saw how a group of cars can detach. Imagine there's this track it's going down that goes from east to west. It comes to a clover leaf. Some of those cars want to go south. Some might want to go north, and some might want to stay with the train. All the ones that want to go south detach. Actually, the ones who want to go north detach, you know, first and go into a side lane, and they'll, on the clover leaf, they'll line up and wait for a northbound train, okay? And when the northbound train comes, they'll speed up. That train will slow down to 60 miles an hour. It'll merge in and keep going. So at every intersection, cars can go where they want. So you don't need one of these railroad sorting things where they, railroads used to have this thing where a freight train comes in, all the cars branch out in a big tree-like structure, and then they're made up into new trains and so on. Here you just have everything moving all the time. My sort of design goal was it does that process at when it's going 60 miles an hour, and when it's cruising it's going 200 miles an hour. The other idea goes like this. The car that meets you at CMU has a driver, and he's in another vehicle that's coupled to your vehicle. And his vehicle has an internal combustion engine, and it supplies electrical power to yours, so it's not really towing yours, even though they're connected. It's not having to pull. Yours drives itself, as it were. So that guy's like a taxi driver, and he would drive to CMU, pick you up. You get into this thing. He drives to the assembly area, like the train station area, and he lets go of the vehicle. There, the vehicle drives by itself from that area to line up with other vehicles that want to catch the next train. Okay, so then they autonomously merge together, and that little group merges into the next train that goes along, and then that train proceeds. Your vehicle might detach and catch another train as time goes along to get to the right place. And then it finally detaches, goes to another assembly area where it's met by a driver on one of these vehicles who hooks up to yours and takes you to your destination. So you do the whole trip door to door, or you can, without having to get out of the vehicle. So this kind of system, if it can maintain 200 miles an hour while going down the track, which is a fairly reasonable speed for like the TGV in France and high-speed trains elsewhere, with various delays and such, basically, you know, you can make a trip to Chicago and beat any airline time, because door-to-door, even going at 200 miles an hour. And if you have this kind of system for freight, a company that loads up one of these things with stuff, say, in Miami, that wants it to get to Seattle, it can deliver overnight from any point in continental United States to any other point. And the idea of the miniaturization is that the infrastructure costs go down, the roadway or the track. And, you know, if this is designed right, maybe it could be one, use up a lane in a free, in the interstate highway system, or who knows what. So now here's what the 16-year-old with SolidWorks tried to do, was to design some of these cabins that take you from one place to another. And he, instead of designing something like the corporate jet, he worried about the high density seating one. This is a little car that seats, I think it's something like 12 people, yeah. Okay, so here's his, he showed me a picture looking like this. I wondered why it seemed to be floating in midair and why there was a wall back there, but I shouldn't ask too many questions. It actually has an interior with seats and everything, all of which he managed to design. This is 2 weekends and 2 school nights worth of work. But he did about 30 drawings, which I'll just show you. Here's the seats he, whoops, this thing's running away by itself. Seats he did. There's a train, and I'll explain how this train gets to have a kind of smooth surface, smooth exterior. Some of the other structure, another view. And here he's going to show how things merge together. The design has these flaps on either end of these vehicles, and while he's showing it with an open front, the design includes that it can have the front sealed up, but then can open up so a person could walk from one to the other. But the flaps, like you can see back here, going back or over here, these are designed so that when the vehicles come together, the end and they couple, even though one vehicle's a little ways from the other, the exterior surface is smooth, just for a windage, for air resistance being low. And the interesting thing about SolidWorks, which I didn't realize, is that when you design this with all these pieces that got to work, when you bring them together, you can't physically move them together in SolidWorks unless there's clearance for it to happen. In other words, it's a fairly fancy drawing system. So,
why would you walk into another car?
Okay, I'll explain exactly. Okay, the car that picks you up here is the first class car. Now, you have to go down to some terminal to catch the coach one. Okay, so when you get in the coach car that's heading west, not everybody in it's going to the same place. But while the train's running, you know, he can be told, hey, you have to change to the car that's going to go south at the next intersection. Okay, and you'd have to pick up your bags and walk through to car, from car 7 to car 12. And then it would, okay, and the reason is not everyone leaving a particular place is going to the same place. And the point is to resolve all those issues and make it all work out while you're moving, as opposed to getting off at a station, waiting for another train, et cetera. Is that okay? So some of these, he designed this seat from scratch. He tried to find a SolidWorks seat somewhere, but he couldn't, so he just went and designed a seat and so on. So anyway, that's the talk. And the idea is this. I'll just mention the highest level idea. I think CMU ought to have a project And what the project ought to be is to think about how to make transportation happen, not by, say, pushing even further on technologies, but by looking at technologies that we've already developed and already know how to use and use and make use of things like the features that Toyota has stuck into many of their vehicles and so on, and look at the process that could happen to convert a lot of the transportation energy to electric power and how to come up with palatable ways to generate a lot more electrical power through nuclear power plants. So my goal in all this is to see if I can get some people here interested in that kind of project. You know, the first step is to think about it, write a proposal, and find someone to support it. So that's the talk. Thanks. Yep, questions?
Yeah, I just wonder if you think that the United States has a population density to be able to afford this kind of infrastructure.
Yeah.
Because, you know, in this part of the country, especially in a place like Pittsburgh, certainly people live in a dense environment.
Yeah.
In places like Boston, that's the case. But you go out to many parts of the country, there.
Yeah. This is a big question because we can't afford covering the United States with TGV-like transportation. So this is an attempt to end up with a much, much lower per mile infrastructure cost. In other words, the whole idea like of the miniaturization or maybe having these be rubber tired vehicles. I'm lucky I have a friend who is like the world's authority on rubber tired vehicles that go 200 miles an hour or faster than that. And he was able to answer lots of questions as to the practicality of various things for me. His name is Adrian Reynard, and he's a very famous race car designer and, you know, builder of race cars. So the point is that I had in mind the United States and solving that particular problem. And so that's why you don't just come up with like a TGV-like solution that works well in Europe but wouldn't work here. So I think that, the idea is to have the roadway that these vehicles use either be maybe stolen, a lane stolen from the interstate highway systems, or a dedicated one that costs much less to implement than a TGV-like system.
Well, and if it's going to do door-to-door, wouldn't you have to do this on every street?
No. No, you miss the point entirely. Take Los Angeles. Say you put the power strip only on the freeways. Okay, fine. It's only hybrid vehicles on that part. Well, you have to not wait. You have to separate two things. I talked about, you know, the power strip and hybrid vehicles, and then I talked about this, transportation system. Okay, so for the hybrid system, it can be completely incremental. Anywhere as you put it, you start getting an advantage, okay, from the use of power point of view. As for the other system, you know, that's, a whole from scratch new system. And, you know, it would require the kind of expenditures like building the interstate highway system. You know, that cost about, I think it was $200 or $300 billion back then. In today's money, it's probably, you know, closer to $1 trillion. And, this would require a very big investment. But the point is, you know, you have to look at it and see whether you get a return on that investment. Yes?
So, practical issue. So we built some robots that, we tried to build some robots that got power from an external source, like this strip of yours. We found that there was a huge tension between the contact resistance and the friction. So what we'd like to do is make a, you want a lot of low contact resistance, so you need them to be very finely made. That, of course, produces a lot of friction, at least in the material fluid. address that?
Well, the best analysis is to look at like brushes on a motor and the pickups that are used for trains and so on and so forth. And what it turns out is that there's a process that if you have a copper strip and you have carbon brushes on it, there's a kind of like physical change that happens to the surface of the copper with time. And this is well known to motor designers and so on. And as a consequence of that, you end up with a very low friction system. And so if you do an experiment and build something and measure the friction, you get the wrong answer unless you've had it running for a long time. So it was it's kind of fortuitous, or that's why the carbon brush succeeded, because of that process. And if you ever look at the commutator, it has a funny look to it, the surface. It's a partly chemical process. I don't know exactly as to how it gets conditioned, but. Yep.
I couldn't tell whether you were thinking that by putting these cars together in a train, we would save energy.
Yeah.
Or there was some other motivation. But if it's for saving energy, how much do you save if, say, you put 100 cars together and let them drive as a train instead of have 100 independent cars?
Well, there's two kinds of air resistance. One is if you have, you know, a sheet going this way, or a skin, like the skin of an airplane, that has a certain air resistance. And there's some tricks you can do to lower it. Actually, it's conceivable that some kind of boundary layer control would actually make sense in a train even of this kind. But the frontal friction, you know, which is normally, you can think of it as a flat plate going into the wind and so on, is a lot more. So if one of these cars is going by itself, you know, it probably takes as much power at 60 mile or 70 miles an hour going by itself as it would take at 200 miles an hour going in a train. So the train concept is really to reduce power. And it has another kind of advantage. Once you've coupled these things together, people can go from one to another. That's one thing. And the other thing is it makes it for much higher traffic density. The number of cars, in other words, trains can follow each other reasonably closely when they're all automated, but still, by having, you know, 100 vehicles in a train or 200 in a train, you end up using the length of track very efficiently. So there are lots of reasons. And there's a safety reason, too. The particular method by which the TGV couples is very inventive and different. The sort of bogey is almost like a kind of independent thing between two cars, and they're both attached to it, okay? And I've tried to figure out ways to sort of implement that kind of thing here, and when they've had accidents and derailments, it's been amazingly good at keeping the train together and people not being injured. No one's been killed in a TGV accident who was a passenger on the train. I mean, I think someone was hit by one or something like that, but yeah. So there are a lot of reasons to put it in a train. And here, you know, and energy is one of them. I think it's probably more than a factor of two in energy to move the thing. The only thing you're fighting is wind resistance. One of the nice things is modern race car design is all aerodynamics. And in fact, in talking to Adrian Raynard, he has his company, they have a wind tunnel. And this is for racing cars. And it turns out that every conventional wind tunnel in the world fails totally at the interaction with the road and the moving wheels and all that. Well, his wind tunnel, which has the road surface goes at the same speed as the wind, okay, and it's a moving belt, and the tires on the vehicle in the wind tunnel rotate, and all of this is necessary. And he's also got probably the best computational fluid dynamics people in the world. They really want to win Formula One and or IndyCar racing and so on. So they know a lot about all of that, and you know.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to pick you up at Sunny Ledge, I hear.